Hello and welcome to what I think is the fourth audio presentation for Philosophy of Astrology. To save time and energy, I am skipping the theme music and stuff like that. Maybe we'll add it someday, but for now, let's just get to the material. So I'm on the track here of whether or not and how astrology is a science, and I've mentioned previously that there's several definitions or concepts of science. So remembering some of that, that we are in the science of observation rather than the science of direct proof. Let's talk about what an astrology chart is, and let's begin that with a discussion of the concept of time, because I think ultimately astrology is a time measurement and time navigation tool. Our concept of time that we are taught as a child is linear. Physicists call it the arrow of time. We experience time as an arrow flying through the air. It only goes in one direction. It can't turn back. And that's the explanation for example, you know, when you mix milk in your coffee, you can't unmix it because time only goes in one direction, which is kind of humorous because it's attempting to use physics to explain chemistry. But whatever, maybe that's true. I think this model of time is ridiculous and demonstrably wrong. We know that even in poetry, in nature, time has a certain property of things existing simultaneously, such that events at one along one part of the line can occur on the other end of the line or another point along the line, if indeed there is even any kind of a line. And if we look at astrology as a model of time, what we have are a bunch of spirals that interplay with one another, rather than one fleeting arrow flying along. And it will help when you look at the chart, and I'm going to get into this further along down the line when we talk more about progressed horoscopes, as a demonstration of a philosophy. The chart is moving. So there's one way to look at a chart, which is it's a bunch of particles splattered on the page, which each land in wedges of pizza. And then you can quickly look those up in a book, and they tell you what, you know, tell you what they mean and who and what you are or what's happening. But that is not really reading astrology. And it's sort of the training wheels level that everyone needs to go through. And all astrologers at any point in their career get curious about the commentaries from the books, and plenty of times I'll go look something up in Isabel Hickey or Barbara Hahn Clow or Robert Hahn, just to be prompted, reminded what someone else said about something, but that's still not reading astrology. So setting that aside for a second, there's the particle concept of the chart as being particles splattered on a pizza. And then if you imagine that chart is a moment in time, it is a seemingly static representation of a whole bunch of waveforms. So all of those points, the sun, the moon, Chiron, Saturn, Jupiter, Venus, Mars, and all of them, they are all moving. And the chart that you see is a kind of a freeze frame, which I may have discussed this. I'm kind of jumping around the order, but we will get to this for sure in the next one. The chart is the planets move in a chaos pattern, and the chart is a sample of that chaos pattern, and that is called a fractal. So if you look up a fractal, just type it into Google, imagine that that is one frame in a constantly moving and evolving evolution of essentially mathematical equations. And that's exactly what's going on in an astrology chart. The positions of those planets are no longer calculated by observation. They are calculated by a computer that tells us where they are based on sophisticated equations that that people like Kepler and Newton initially worked out that point to exactly where they are based on mathematics. And so underneath that chart is a whole bunch of mathematics. Now, there are some of my older students who took an astrology class like in 1973, and you had to learn how to use logarithms, and you had to do interpolation, and you had to learn how to calculate sidereal time. I jumped in after you had to do all of that. I know that it's there. I have paper ephemerides that have logarithmic tables and tables of houses and all this stuff. However, there's a lot of mathematics below this chart, kind of crunching and humming along, but which a computer now can do in half a snap of a finger. However, if you see that chart as a still thing, you'll have one concept of it. But if you see it as a moving thing, if you think of it as a slice of rope, for example, and you're looking straight into a slice, like a, you know, you cut a rope and you're looking at it, and there's millions of threads and strands in there, that's more accurate. But the rope is still a line, but all of those different threads, so it's not a perfect metaphor, but all those different threads, first of all, are cycling in different orbits at different speeds at different points in their orbit, and that is essentially never the same twice. There's no day ever again that's going to be like today. Maybe if you could calculate, you know, in a trillion years, I don't know what the probability odds of it are, but if you could, you know, in some astronomical, interestingly, length of time, there might be something where all the variables add up. And every time you add a variable, it gets more difficult it lowers the probability of ever having that that day repeat. It maybe will add a trillion years on to it if you toss in, you know, a couple of asteroids. So, first of all, imagine that each one of those planets represents a cycle, a moving cycle, and that at the point at which you're looking at the chart, everything is in a cycle at some point. Then, imagine that all the other cycles relate to all the other cycles. Here we have a much more interesting and accurate concept of time. On a few different instances, I've experienced or observed, depending on when, that time is more like a loosely drawn spirograph. You remember the spirograph thing where there's a gear wheel with the teeth on the inside of the wheel, and then you take a gear out of the box, you pick a little gear, and then maybe it's the size of a silver dollar or a half dollar, and then you stick a pen or a pencil in the thing and you draw along. I'm going to order a spirograph set as soon as I finish this recording and just see what it's like to play with. That is a more accurate model of time, except that the spirograph of actual time is much looser. It's much more chaotic. And one line may only cross over another line on an extremely rare occasion. Instead of, as the spirograph is going round and around, there's going to be the recrossing over on a regular basis. You can see this modeled in a book that I highly recommend that everyone get, called, hold on, turn around. It is called, and it is never far from my desk, and I hope it's not far from my desk today. It's by Neil Mickelson, and it's called Tables of Planetary Phenomena. It's a yellow book. It's like 8.5 by 11 size, large book. And you might have to get a copy used. And this has stuff that's not on the internet, all in one place. And one of the things it has on the internet, all in one place, are, for example, a spirograph representation of the Venus cycle and a spirograph representation of the Mars cycle. But the Venus cycle, for example, you can see that five-pointed star that Venus makes when it makes its retrogrades. And that's part of the cycle. The retrogrades, which are caused by the movement of the Earth around the Sun, are part of that cycle. So you can see that there is a very stable, at least at this time in history, stable representation of Venus, which bounces around a five-point star, and the five-point star slowly drifts. A planet like Mars has a much less symmetrical orbit, which concentrates over at, relative to Earth, concentrates over at one end of the zodiac. So there are certain signs where there's lots of Mars retrogrades in our time, in our epoch, and there are times, there are signs when there's many fewer Mars retrogrades. Obviously, this drifts, and it will eventually even out in the very long haul, but in any one, you know, phase of history or lifetime, you can see that there's a concentration of Mars leaning into one side. Okay, now you can overlay Venus and Mars, and you get a Mouret pattern. You get a pattern where these two things overlap. I think that, and so this is fairly precise, because we know exactly where these planets are going to be, and we've got the formulas down. And this has been, the real breakthroughs in doing this were done in the lifetimes of Kepler and Sir Isaac and whoever the Scottish dude, I believe, was who invented logarithmic tables, which kind of abbreviated mathematics and made things go much quicker, made the slide rule possible and all this. I think the actual natural organic model of time is much, much less visually symmetrical, much more chaotic, much more complex, but that there are these overlaps. And this is a interesting scenario for science fiction, where are we today? Maybe where the Earth is today is overlapping some, you know, day in like 1312, and the day takes on a certain cast because there is this overlap of a previous point in space-time where there were certain events. Now, of course, the world is complex, and even with a much lower population, there are wildly, vastly different things going on different sides of the planet. Excuse me. Though the thing they have in common is quite a bit of control drama. Control drama seems to be the thing that stalks the human race wherever it goes, and it's one of the things we need to, I think, address in ourselves. Okay, so this is not about so much about astrological interpretation as much as it is knowing what a chart is when you look at it, knowing what some of the potentials are, and understanding that an astrology chart is a sophisticated model of looking at the cycles of time. Depending on how many planets you use, I'm looking at what I call a basic chart now with about 25 points, plus the astrological houses and the ascendant. This is a 25-handed clock. And so just like the second hand gives you more precision against the minute hand and against the hour hand, these cycles of varying degrees give a kind of, on one level, precision. They present an absolutely unique concept of where we are in the journey through space and time. And unlike a stopped clock, it is not right twice a day. It's always different. In a sense, it's always wrong. And what, or always right, depending on how you want to look at it. And the difference is that 3:15 of its own, to most normal mortal humans, does not mean anything inherently. But quarter moon or full moon does mean something inherently from the standpoint of astrology. It has a historical context. It has a hormonal context. It has a poetic context, right? We have certain times that have that, like the stroke of midnight or high noon. You know, we have these kind of bullshit type of metaphors that are used, but there's really not that many. What do we have? Half past a cow's ass. Okay, that's exciting. How did the Chinaman remember his dentist appointment? It was at 2:30. Ha ha. Besides that, 3:15 or 11:30 or 12:45, these times don't have any meaning. But the conjunction of Venus and the Moon, you could start talking about that right away. And how is that? Okay, so the first thing we have with the cycles, first with the chart, is we're looking at a freeze frame of moving cycles, many, many moving cycles, all of which interplay and interact with one another. And by the way, in the physics of calculating these orbits, astronomers started to discover, especially as gravity was figured out, which now gravity has really been figured out at least four separate times, once by Kepler, once by Newton, once by Einstein, and then once by the quantum people. So there's basically, and there are three completely different models of gravity. Newton and Kepler were pretty much onto the same thing. Newton figures it out and puts it into words. And then Einstein just tosses that whole thing and finds out, you know, basically that the orbit of Mercury is too short. There's an aberration in the, not very much, but the sun bends gravity because of a relativity effect. It's crazy. So all of these different points are interplaying off of one another gravitationally. Thematically, in astrology, they are also playing off of one another. So, for example, Venus right now is in Taurus. It's approaching Uranus. It's 2 degrees. So I get information about Venus. I get information about Uranus. I get information about Taurus. And I get information about 2 degrees. And it's also high in the sky. It's near the sun. It's 12 minutes past. It's 9 minutes past noon, daylight time, which means that it's 11:09 standard time, blah, blah, blah. All of that then gets translated into what we call meaning. But I'm suggesting here that because everything is playing off of everything else, and because there's no definitive meaning to anything, that the concept of meaning, in a sense, be left out of astrology. Kind of is, there must be a metaphor for this somewhere in philosophy or mathematics, but maybe you could say, leaving it as a variable or as a term that is undefined so that you don't clutter up your mind with a finite definition of something. Now, if you study the chart, and there's a number of programs that will let you see the chart moving. One of them is IoSprite. If you have an older Mac, I can send it to you. If you have a newer Mac, I don't know if it works on PC. Lots of programs on PC. Get Astro Gold, and you can experiment with watching the whole solar system move. You can set the with IoSprite, you can set the solar system moving at the fastest, something like 180 days a second, I think. And you can watch your whole life go by in 3 minutes. That's interesting. And so what you're seeing is that there's all of these interwoven spirals. This is a different concept than splattering particles onto the page and then looking them up. It is much more dynamic. There's much more interplay. There's much more of a dance and a sense of movement. And if you connect to that energy of movement and you remember that everything is moving, it is much more fun to read the chart because you recognize that that there's motion. I'll give you an example. I was reading a chart this morning, and the chart had the sun in the last degree of Leo, right in the middle of the last degree, 2930 or so, and Pluto in the fourth degree of Virgo, 3.5 degrees. That's occupying the fourth degree. They're 4 degrees separated. So I said, something happened. Tell me about 4 years old. Obviously, there was some kind of an event, because by progression, using a day per year method, you count the sun moving 1 degree per year in the day per year method. We'll get into this in the next discussion about holography and fractalization and representative models of time. But in any event, I could see, because the sun had 4 degrees to cross before it got to Pluto, that represented an event at 4 years old. That's because when I see the chart, I see a moving thing, not a still thing. This includes a natal chart. You have to learn how to see the chart moving to be able to read astrology. And this gets into predictive astrology, but I'm suggesting that we stay away from predictive astrology and understand what we're doing when we do predictive astrology or claim to be doing predictive astrology. But you do want to see the movement and not get caught in this thing is a static stuck thing, because when you're looking at your own natal chart, you are not a static stuck thing. You are a thing in motion. Time is moving. All these planetary cycles are moving. There are numerous sub-dimensions of time moving, primary directions, secondary progressions, tertiary, and all these other formulations of the movement of time that move the chart along. And after a while, you'll almost always remember that you're looking at the light, like a flash goes off, and you're looking at an instantaneous freeze frame of a thing that kept moving. So your own natal chart is time for your birth, and it's supposedly a special important time, but the time marches on after that. So that's your particular moment. That's your particular identifier. That degree rising is your degree rising at that location, place, time, latitude, longitude, and all that stuff. But that keeps moving. 4 minutes later, new degree rising. Half an hour later, the moon has moved so many arc minutes. Right? And so when you use a method like progressions, whether you can read progressions or not, I recommend looking at the progress chart side by side with the natal chart, if for no other reason than to remind you that the chart has moved since the time it was cast for. It is generally, progressions are, everything is slowed down to 1/365th scale, that is to say, day per year method of reading. That's, progressions are a scale model of time, but despite it being a scale model, things are moving, and you're reminded that things are moving. And when you look at a progress chart, the tendency is, ooh, the sun's in this house. Oh, the moon's in that house. Oh, that's all different. Now Saturn's in that house. Oh, wow. Now that changed signs. That's going back to the particle method of the pain splattered. It's missing that there is a continual connection between the time indicated in the natal chart and the time indicated in the progress chart. Everything has moved to the new place and continues to move, you know, more or less, depending on how you think of time, indefinitely. And the more you can see the chart as a moving thing, as a representation of a moment in time in a model of time where time keeps moving, the easier it will be to tap directly into the qualities and the energy of any chart and get a sense of what is going on, because a lot of what's going on is represented by the movement. Now, I haven't heard back from this client with the sun and Pluto separated by 4 degrees. It is possible, at least 50-50, that whatever occurred to her as a 4-year-old, when the sun, by progression, made a conjunction to Pluto, shaped her whole life. And it's in fact inevitable that whatever was going on at that time shaped her life, even if nobody remembers it, but chances are someone's going to remember it, that she knows what happened. She probably has a direct memory of that time in her life and can describe the events at that time. So what I'm suggesting here is that we move from a particle theory of the chart to a wave theory of the chart, a planet wave theory of the chart, and that then at the same time, everything lands in a house in the chart. And so what we're doing is we're imposing a model of time over a model of consciousness, which is a metaphor for directions in space. This gets complicated if you think about it too hard. I mean, Rob once said, well, astrology is clearly the most complicated divination system. It's like, well, yeah, it's definitely a divination system, and it's definitely really complicated. And I will cover in a future discussion astrology as a divination system, what that really means, what it means, you know. And this is the topic of the book, The Moment of Astrology. Almost everyone registered in this class is capable of reading The Moment of Astrology. You need to know a little bit of astrology to read The Moment of Astrology. So first we have but you know enough, and it is absolutely worth reading this thing and loving it, because there are things in there that are just, like, I think some of the best stuff written, and it is one of the best critiques of science ever written. But it's a little bit oblique. It's not a broadside attack on science, but it ends up being, without trying to be, a critique of conventional scientific method, which doesn't hold up so good. It's like a little bit like people say, well, has science ever proven astrology? It's like, well, has science ever proven that the Beatles made beautiful music? Well, I'm not aware of any studies. Maybe there are. Maybe we should look in PubMed or whatever the hell. Maybe somebody proved it, but I don't think so. And therefore, why do we want to subject this what is ultimately a poetic method of interpretation based in science, just like poetry is based in language, which letters have histories and meanings, but the poem stands of itself and can't be proven to be anything. A painting can't be proven to be beautiful, and a song can't be proven to be beautiful, and a chart cannot be proven to be true, because when we move from the science of it, all the mathematics and the discovery of all the planets and the computer technology that leads to this and the ephemeris being created and everything like that, the next step that happens is consciousness enters, and then there is an interpretation, which is not true. It's just an interpretation. Now, where this discussion of cycles goes is, well, we could certainly study cycles a lot more. And if you want to really get the feel for planetary cycles, you study the sun and the moon cycle for a while, a couple of years, which you may have done, but it's an important exercise for all astrology students, so that you are able to take a pulse, so that you are able to get the feeling for what a rhythm sounds like and feels like. And then comes, what are these points about? And here is where we get into this concept of, word, not the best word, archetype. As long as we remember that archetypes are alive, living, breathing, changing, transforming, reinterpreted, we deal with them, they deal with us. We, as Crowley said, we live with them and they live with us. Speaking of the major arcana in the tarot, these planets have stories, they have meaning. And somebody like Rick Tarnas will call those archetypes. And so what we have is a combination of cycles and archetypes, meaning kind of a profile, a concept, a delineation, and then the two are imposed over one another. And then from there we start to get ideas, concepts, messages, so-called meaning. All right. I'm doing these informally from very loose notes. I think that one of the best methods of learning astrology is to talk about it with people, is to converse about it. A lot of people have learned astrology by having a boyfriend or a girlfriend who was an astrologer, and I have taught lots of girlfriends astrology. Some of them have become professional astrologers, at least one that I can think of, Maria Hensler, and another one, and let's see, Hummingbird, and then who else? There's a few lingering around over the decades as Book of Blue models became professional models and some became photographers through the process. This is an art that is partly taught by experience and partly taught by books, but I think one of the best ways to convey it is let's talk about it, which is why it's ridiculous to ban the discussion of astrology during the off hours of an astrological seminar, which sometimes happens. We're only going to talk about astrology during class time. Well, no, you want to be talking about it half drunk at 4 o'clock in the morning, like the time that I walked into. I was at a conference with Wilcock, David Wilcock. We were besties for a couple of years, and we were at a Project Hindsight conference where they were teaching sect. Essentially, the use of essential dignities, fall and I'm not able to conjure the left. Let's see, exaltation, detriment, fall, triplicity, ruler, term, and face. A lot of different dignities, right? Venus rules Taurus, but there's lots of those, right? There's moon is exalted in Taurus, and so forth. A whole bunch of those, and they got I don't know from what era. Maybe in medieval times, sect was given a score. So you got, this planet was evaluated by a score. In other words, I have Saturn in Aquarius. That gets a couple of points. It's direct. That gets a point. It's on the day side of a day chart. That gets a few points. It is not combust the sun. That gets a few points. And then things take points away. If it can combust the sun, it loses points. If it's exactly conjunct the sun within 11 arc minutes, then it gets lots and lots of points. So it's kind of a point system. And we walked in to imagine a garden variety ordinary motel in Ithaca, New York, you know, where all the rooms are on the first floor. And the door was open. It was midsummer. And we walked in, and there was a bunch of people with a big set of Tinker Toys, assembling their concept of a three-dimensional model of Rob Hand's chart using the rules of sect. So these seem like pretty smart people who were like trying to figure this out, and they seemed to be well on the way. And they were translating these ancient rules of astrology into this three-dimensional model built with Tinker Toys using Rob Hand's chart. It was quite hilarious. It was. We didn't stay long. We just looked at it and thought, "Wow, this is really exciting!" And have fun. And we left. And we moved on. So that's how we spent a lot of the conference, was tooling around. And so one of the sub themes of that conference, Phase Three, the third phase conference. This is, I think, in the summer of 96. It starts in 4, 5, 6. It was definitely the summer of 96 or 97. Is that astrology has to be, well, certainly it doesn't have to be. It could be damn boring. But the chart is yours. The chart is yours to play with, to scribble on, to experiment with, to print the size of a house, and then cover in 50 coats of paint and varnish and plaster of Paris and gesso, whatever the heck you want to do with it. To take your chart and to loosen up your concept, even as you're busy studying the exact placements, and you've got you know, Venus conjunct Uranus and Taurus, and you've looked up all those different things, Venus and Taurus, Uranus and Taurus, Venus conjunct Uranus, in 20 books, and you're studying rigorously, et cetera, et cetera. Still, your chart is yours to do stuff with because your life is yours to do stuff with, to experiment with, to paint on, to create with, to whatever whatever it is that you want to do. And, you know, I think that the study of astrology is in many ways a Virgo art, this art of precision and calculation and cerebral and cognitive and historical. And then on the other side of that spectrum, it is a Pisces art. Somewhere in on the internet is a reprint of an article I wrote for the Mountain Astrologer on Virgo and Pisces about the way that astrology is a study in the qualities of Virgo, the cerebral qualities of Pisces, the artistic and the intuitive, which of course contain one another. I will try to find that. I'll try to find that article and see if I can get myself a spirograph, like a vintage spirograph. And I'm planning to come back in the next one with either a discussion of the houses as directions in space, which are directions in consciousness. That might be a good one to do, a discussion of the houses. And I highly recommend the class. It's all in the houses for a more thorough discussion of my concept of the houses. And there's, if you type in, quote, it's all in the houses, close quote, Patrick Walker quote, you'll find lots of stuff by me on that theme, because ultimately, at the end of the day, it is. It comes down to the houses. The ability to read astrology, no matter how good you are at planets and cycles and the archetypes, ultimately comes down to the houses, because that tells you the context of what is going on. If you don't have context, you don't have anything. All right. So, meanwhile, email me if you'd like, efc@planetwaves.net. Keep the discussion going. I'm about to write to all students and say this thing is up. And I've still got some congestion from a cold a couple of weeks ago. I guess that makes me a Mullen long hauler. All right. Thanks for listening. And bye for now.